This is the Nichols Patrick Current Federal Tax Developments for the week of November 21st, 2016. This week, delays reign. The Nichols Patrick Current Federal Tax Developments is brought to you by Nichols Patrick CPE and your State Society of CPAs. We're going to take a look this week on some interesting things that have happened. We're going to start first with a taxpayer who believed that there were different rules if you claimed an auto was used 100% for business than there would be for other autos. We find that a religious organization found that it couldn't get tax-exempt status for a coffee shop it planned to operate. The Fifth Circuit overturned the tax court on the question of whether MoneyGram was a bank. We also have a 1031 exchange where we look at the question of related parties in a 1031 exchange. And does the fact that we had no prearranged plans and we didn't, in the end, recognize more gain or less gain than otherwise would have been recognized by the two parties combined, does that combine to mean there was no tax avoidance? We then also look at the IRS removing the 36-month test for having to issue a Form 1099-C. Then we look at the delays this week. That is, the IRS has extended the dates for providing employees and customers of insurance companies with the Forms 1095 B and C for 2016, delayed that by 30 days. And the IRS has gone ahead to 2017 to delay the date for when educational institutions will have to report tuitions paid rather than being able to use tuitions billed on Form 1098-T. They were already allowed to skip that for 16. We're now going to get that for 17. Well, we're coming up here now toward the end of the CPE season before we get to the end of 2016. And if you look forward on your calendar, there are some courses coming up. A couple I want to highlight this week, another presenter, Don Cochran for Nichols Patrick, is going to be presenting a pair of courses in Boise, Idaho, coming up on December 6th and 7th. On the 6th, he'll be presenting a course on pass-through entities advanced issues. And on the 7th, he'll be doing corporate taxation, subchapter C for C and S corporations. That course will look at the items that affect all corporations, whether they've elected S status or not. Those courses, again, if you want to look for those, if you're in Boise area, you can sign up for those by going to the Idaho Society of CPAs website. I'm going to be doing some additional traveling. As I mentioned before, I'm going to be going to Oklahoma the week after Thanksgiving to do a series of courses there. And this coming week on Wednesday, I have a course related to that same corporate taxation, C&S Corp issues, on Wednesday at the Arizona Society of CPAs office and being broadcast by them. We say we're getting to this very end of the year time frame. So you've got a little more time to select your CPE. So be sure to check your state society's offerings for the rest of 2016 and pick up those courses before we get past the middle of December when everybody just starts thinking about end of the year, going someplace, and we end up suddenly discovering that we don't have time to do the CPE that we thought we were going to be doing. With that, let's get started with this week's cases. We're going to start this time with the case of Roy versus Commissioners, depending upon how you want to say that. This is a case under Section 274. A taxpayer believed that there were going to be different rules because he had a car that was not being used, that was being used 100% for business. And in his theory, the rules for having documentation would not necessarily apply in the same way if you were using a car completely for business. Essentially, what he had in this case, he had purchased an Aston Martin vehicle, and that vehicle was being used in his business. The taxpayer apparently was aware that he was supposed to keep records for business use of vehicle, but he believed if you used it 100% for business, you could have very limited documentation. In fact, his documentation in this case was essentially limited to a single sheet of paper that showed mileage at the beginning of the year, mileage at the end of the year for the vehicle, and stated that the car was used 100% for business. The problem that we're going to run into is under Section 274D, that which was added to reverse the result in the Cohen case for specific expenses, and these auto expenses are one of those for which the reversal applies, a taxpayer must have contemporaneous evidence to back up the business use of any kind of passenger vehicle. That includes, not surprisingly, an Aston Martin that you're driving for business. In this case, the problem the taxpayer is going to run into is there is no special rule for 100% business use. The taxpayer still has to document for each trip or I should rephrase that. The taxpayer needs contemporaneous documentation to support that 100% item. That documentation is going to need to, at least for a reasonable portion of the year, consist of some sort of log that outlines, you know, what he did, where he went, you know, point to point every day. So presumably the taxpayer could document this if he chose, let's see, 3 or 4 months during the year, kept his log for what he did, noted where he went every day, and fundamentally noted that it was 100% business use. Not quite sure why the taxpayer seemed to believe that if he just said it was 100% business use, there wouldn't be a problem, but I guess his idea was, well, there's nothing to document. Everything I drove was for business. That's a nice assertion, but it's still got to be proven. Remember, the Cohen rule does not apply to this type of documentation. If you do not meet the strict documentation rules of Section 274D, what we're going to find is you're going to be stuck with having to claim no deduction, which unfortunately for this gentleman was what he got for all the medical expenses he had related to his Aston Martin. By the way, the citation for this case, I think I forgot to give it you right away, is TC Summary Opinion 2016-77. It came out on November 15th. The tax court, as we know, not surprisingly, disallowed every one of his deductions related to that car. That is also something to remind your clients the result if they don't keep the necessary records for anything covered by 274D. 274D covers, in addition to the autos or any other listed property, which includes, by the way, computers not used exclusively at the business location of the employer and owned by the employer, would also include travel, any entertainment expenses, and any gifts given to clients. So you need to be sure that all of that has the backup contemporaneously in order to ensure that you do not just get a complete disallowance of the deduction. Next up, we have a charitable organization that decided that it was going to open up a coffee shop. This is Private Letter Ruling 2016-45017. This was the entity's application for tax-exempt status for that coffee shop. What happened in this case is a minister, who was one of the founding board members of the religious organization, came up with a vision to form a coffee shop. And his idea was that believers and non-believers would be able to interact here. So we put a coffee shop someplace where there weren't really enough coffee shops. We would therefore get the people to come in the door, buy coffee, sit down, and in theory, believers could engage them while they were there at the coffee shop. So it would be a safe and friendly environment. They had a separate entity to encourage other churches to become part of this organization. And essentially, they say at least one of the directors must be from the original founding church. And a majority of your directors should be members of this organization. Now, this coffee shop will be open Monday through Friday, 6 a.m. to 8 p.m., Sunday from 7 a.m. to 8 p.m. It would have free Wi-Fi and power outlets. The coffee sourced from coffee farmers, so he has fair trade coffee. It would include all the standard things you'd find at a coffee shop, coffee, tea, smoothies, frappes, soft drinks, juices, have baked goods, soup, sandwiches, salads, and desserts. They put copies of the menu on their website so you could figure out what the menu was. Shows the prices freeze. Also sells the roasted coffee beans online in the future, but they can't do that right now. They can. The customers, though, can purchase those roasted beans from the coffee shop inside the store. Now, so far, as you may notice, this doesn't sound like something terribly different from what you would see in your average coffee shop if you walked into it. They were going to provide locations inside there for formal and informal Bible study, church group meetings, and meetings for other organizations. Now, the catch is, while it's been used for those sorts of things, it's also been used for bridal showers, business meetings, game nights, live music. In essence, anybody that wants access to this room can get access to it if they book it. While they suggest a donation, they've not denied use of the rooms to anybody who did not make the donation. All of the profits from this coffee shop would go to support the religious organization. Now, the catch was they wanted tax-exempt status for this. The problem is, the IRS notes, that this is fundamentally a for-profit operation that just happens to be run by a religious organization and which might have some religious benefits. One of the IRS notes, they didn't restrict, you know, it wasn't that they continually, if you went in there, you'd be part of a religious meeting. they didn't have the coffee served, you know, as an add-on to the meetings or the religious meetings would be in that building. Rather, the coffee was there, and then they kind of hoped some sort of religious interaction would take place. The IRS notes that, unfortunately, this looks a lot like a regular coffee shop. Looks a lot like the regular sort of thing. And presumably, you know, they had employees who were going to run and be the baristas. They had everything look like normally served all the normal food of a coffee shop. They had scouted out the area to determine that there weren't competing coffee shops in the area. So that was kind of like a business operation. Based on that, the IRS determined that this organization was not being run for religious purpose. The mere fact that you're going to devote the entity to a tax-exempt purpose is not enough. The IRS cites back to a case from 2013, Zagfly versus Commissioner, Tax Court Memorandum Decision 2013-29, for this position. In the Zagfly case, we had a company that was being founded. It was going to send all of its profits to tax-exempt entities. As the IRS noted in that case, that doesn't make you a tax-exempt organization. That essentially puts you in competition with business. That's basically the whole thing the unrelated business income tax is also supposed to stop charitable organizations from doing. But if your organization really has nothing, you know, its primary goal is business related, it's not just a UBIT problem. It now turns around and becomes a qualification problem for you becoming a charitable organization. So this organization was denied tax-exempt status because the IRS concluded it simply was not primarily being operated for a charitable purpose. We have the Fifth Circuit overriding the tax court in the case of MoneyGram International and subsidiaries versus Commissioner. This decision from the Fifth Circuit came down on November 15. It is case number 1560527 of the Fifth Circuit. It is a 2-1 split decision. Back at the beginning of 2015, the tax court had ruled that MoneyGram, you know, where you go, you take the money, they'll send it across the country, and your friend or buddy or whoever can pick up the money order there far across the country, that MoneyGram was not actually a bank. Why is this important? MoneyGram had incurred losses on the sale of various securities. One of the special treatments for banks is that banks are allowed to treat that as an ordinary loss. That's very important in this case because this being a corporation, if it's a capital loss, unless they can find some capital gains really quick, this loss is probably going to go totally unutilized. So the tax court said, sorry, guys, this is a capital loss. And they did so by looking at they said you have to meet the general purpose definition of a bank. And they looked at the fact that banks receive deposits and make loans. And the tax court concluded that MoneyGram didn't really do that. The panel in the Fifth Circuit, two of the three judges, agreed that the general definition of the bank is your test and banks make loans and take deposits. What they disagreed on, though, is they believe that the tax court used the wrong definition of making deposits and of taking deposits and making loans. They interpreted that there'd be a much broader definition of that, that A, you could take money to be held for a very short period of time. The theory is what MoneyGram's doing is they take your money, they hold it right up until the person you're sending the money to goes ahead and cashes out the money order, then they pay it out. And they also said, you know, they're making loans, again, on a very limited function. They, you know, there's money advanced worth an expectation of repayment, even though no interest is being charged. So because of that, the tax court found, or the Fifth Circuit found, MoneyGram qualifies as a bank. Now, there was a dissenting opinion that said, okay, maybe the tax court got the detailed definition wrong, but even so, it is really stretching things to view what MoneyGram is doing as taking deposits and making loans in the general way one would view a bank as doing that. Therefore, the dissent held, regardless of whether the tax court might have gotten the definition somewhat wrong, MoneyGram still wouldn't be a bank under the definition that the majority had adopted in this case. Okay, next up, we're looking at whether there is a tax avoidance purpose in a 1031 exchange with a related party. This is the Muulani Group, Limited and Subsidiary versus Commissioner, Tax Court Memorandum Decision 2016-209, issued on November 16th. Now, this taxpayer was a company that owns a lot of buildings. And the taxpayer was looking to dispose of a building. Now, they wanted to, disposing of this real estate, they wanted to do a 1031 exchange. So they found the qualified intermediary. they had the property sold through the qualified intermediary. Now the 45-day period for identifying replacement property runs. They had identified a number of potential properties from non-related parties at the beginning of the 45-day period, but it turns out none of them were going to be able to be reasonably closed as a purchase. In essence, the buyers weren't interested, at least not at the offer that this group was willing to give. So now they're running up to the end of the 45-day period. They had a related organization that was also holding real estate. So they identified property of the related organization during at the end of the 45-day period to basically keep the 1031 exchange in play. That's all well and good, but Internal Revenue Code Section 1031F has special rules that generally disallow 1031 treatment if you have a gain on a sale for a related party. You know, if you have a 1031 exchange with a related party. The taxpayer in this case, though, looked at the fact that 1031F, in this case, 4, or I should say F2C, provides a special rule that says we won't worry about your 1031 exchange with the related party if neither the exchange nor the disposition of property by a related party has one of its principal purposes, the avoidance of federal income tax. The taxpayer in this case argued, well, we obviously weren't looking to do an avoidance transaction with a related party when we first sold the property because we were legitimately looking for a third party to buy the property, to acquire property from. Only when that didn't turn out to be possible did we turn around and enter into a transaction with the related party. And secondly, they noted, the basis of the property held by the related party was actually less than the basis of the property they disposed of. So the related party was reporting a larger gain than what would have been reported had the 1031 exchange collapsed, and they simply had to report the gain. So the taxpayer argued, we obviously therefore did not have a principal purpose of avoiding federal income taxes. The tax court, however, disagreed. The tax court said on the first issue, the fact that there was not a prearranged plan to avoid taxes by exchanging with a related party is not dispositive of the issue. Obviously, if you enter into a transaction with a prearranged plan that you're expecting to avoid taxes by using a related party, that would cause a fail. But merely not having that at the start does not mean you don't have a problem. If the actual exchange involves a related party at the end of the day, then we have to run the test. What about the fact that we're reporting more gain than we would have? Now, normally, that would be a showing of no tax avoidance. Except the tax court said, you don't just stop to see if we reported more gain. Rather, we take a look at the tax effect. It turns out that the related party had a large net operating loss, while the taxpayer did not. So by selling, even though they recognized a larger gain, they paid no tax. Had this 1031 exchange collapsed, this taxpayer would have paid a significant chunk of federal income tax. As such, the court held, since the result was a tax reduction, that's good enough to cause us to have to recognize the 1031 exchange gain. Or we kill the 1031 exchange is what ends up happening. Next up, we have some IRS stuff coming up here toward the end. First thing is, under notice 2015, or under this case, under Treasury Decision 9793, issued on November 10th, the IRS has removed the 36-month test for lenders to issue 1099-Cs for cancellation of debt. Under the prior regulations, it was presumed to be a cancellation of debt reporting event if the taxpayer, let's say the borrower, went 36 months without making any payments on a debt and the lender had not made any significant collection activities during that same 36-month period. When that 36-month period ended, we then looked from the end of 36-month period to December 31st year in question. If those situations continued through that period, no payments made, no collection activities, then as of December 31st, the lender was to issue a 1095-C, show the date of cancellation as December 31st, and send that to the borrower. The IRS had issued proposed regs. They were going to take this away. They've now officially done it. The big thing this is going to cause is you're not going to get a 1099-C now, supposedly, unless there is a specific event for cancellation, such as a write-off on the books of the entity or the expiration of the statute. But the other interesting side is the tax court, in multiple cases, has looked at this 36-month test to determine what year a cancellation took place if, for instance, no 1099-C was issued until maybe 10 years later. Well, the tax court would say no. At the end of the 36-month period, there's a presumption the debt was canceled. Therefore, you know, IRS, you came in too late when you come in after the 1099-C is issued 10 years later. It'll be interesting to see what the tax court does with this rule gone about future cases for cancellation of debt and whether it might get a little, we may find that debts drag out longer before cancellation than they did with this rule in place, even for the taxpayer. That's interesting because this rule was never intended to apply to taxpayers, but the tax court had used it for that. Now, here's the delays coming up. First, notice 2016-17. The IRS has delayed the time for which, this is in those 2016-70-1118 issuance, they've delayed the date where you are going to have to issue to your employees if you're an Apple large employer, or to the insured if you're an insurance carrier, the forms 1095 B or C to your recipients this year. Those should have been issued to those people by January 31st. Now the IRS is going to give everybody a 30-day extension to file to get that form to the recipients that should have the form. That the IRS did note that because they're giving this 30-day extension, they will not allow a second 30-day extension. That is, they're not going to allow you because under the current rules, you had it due to the recipients by January 31st, but you could apply for a 30-day extension. Now they're going to say, no, you can't get an extra 30-day extension now. There'll be no extensions offered. March 2nd is the due date. They also noted they are not changing the date when these things have to get to the IRS for filing. So basically, 1094B and 1094Cs must still be filed with the IRS by February 28th. Interestingly enough, a few days before you have to get the forms to the employees. And they, if you're filing electronically, you can get to March 31st of 2017. The IRS has, again, like last year, provided reasonable cause relief for 1040 filers who file their returns before getting these documents. They could make use of other information they have to determine if they have coverage. Okay, other big changes coming up here. We have additionally, the IRS in announcement 2016-42 has pushed back by 1 year the additional penalty relief for educational institutions that do not report tuition paid, but rather report tuition billed on a 1098-T. The Protecting Americans from Tax Hikes Act last year provided that supposedly effective for 2016 1098-Ts, institutions would have to report fees billed, would have to report tuition paid, not what they billed the students every year. The IRS a while back, in announcement 2016-17, provided for relief that said for 16, you can go ahead and report billed. Well, apparently the education institutions were complaining again that the software is not ready. They need to have it ready by the 1st of January. It won't be ready by then. So the IRS has now pushed this back again. That's great, but it complicates the life for taxpayers and preparers. Remember, we have additional due diligence for preparers if you're claiming the American Opportunity Tax Credits, and taxpayers could face the loss of being able to claim the American Opportunity Tax Credits if they claim an erroneous amount for 2 years. With the fact that 1098-Ts are going to show amounts billed, it's going to be very tempting for taxpayers, especially those using things like TurboTax, to just fill that number in, not noting that they really should be using the amount they paid for the year. For those of us who are preparers, it means we can't just get a 1098-T. We've got to ask specifically, okay, that's what was billed. What did you pay during the calendar year in order to claim the proper credit? The IRS has not said anything either from the initial announcement or this one about any sort of relief for taxpayers who make an error by picking up the wrong number on there. For now, let's presume there won't be any relief. So you're going to have to make sure that you ask people specifically about how much did they pay in tuition. Well, we're coming up on Thanksgiving week. And those of us here at Nichols Patrick and those at the State Society of CPAs across the country want to wish you a happy Thanksgiving for 2017. Hopefully you'll enjoy your couple days off here. Hey, and Black Friday is coming, so enjoy your shopping. You know, all those neat things. Again, we're heading toward the end of the year, so please remember, CPE time is running short. If you want to get that before December 31st, be sure to check your state society catalogs if you need some additional hours. You know, find the courses that are being offered through mid-December before they're going to become rather scarce. You know, we want to be sure those of us at Nicholpatrick are going to be on the road for the most part through December 15th, and your state society is going to be offering a number of courses for the most part through that date, so be sure to check them. This has been the current federal tax developments for the week of November 21st, 2016. Be sure to catch our daily updates, or daily or as often as we get to them during the week, at currentfederaltaxdevelopments.com. You can also download a PDF of the articles on all of today's topics from the weekly updates page. Be sure also, if you have any questions, you can send them to me, or any comments, edzollers@currentfederaltaxdevelopments.com. You can also follow me on Twitter, at edzollers is where you find me on the Twitter. Remember, we love to see you come back here next week. Check in, pick up what we have. We'll see what's developed here. Even during this short week, we'll probably see at least some things happen from the IRS. So check in with us next week when we talk about what's going on in the area of federal taxes.